In the defense of sunlight, how the transition to indoor living created the epidemic of modern chronic disease. Welcome to the Vital Veda Show. I'm your host, Dylan Smith. I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and holistic health educator based in Sydney, Australia, but not confined to that. Traveling around the world, I'll be in Mumbai in the end of October offering workshops, consultations, talks. To be informed about that, sign up to my newsletter or follow the Vedery. And also, I'll be in Melbourne in February. That you'll have to find out via my newsletter. You can sign up to my newsletter on the homepage of my website, vitalveda.com.au. If you ever wanted to go to a retreat in India, rather than going for a retreat, I suggest you go for a pilgrimage. And this October, you have a chance to go with Vedic meditation teachers Rick Little and Jeff Rupp. You can head over to rickandjeff.com. Jeff is spelled G-E-O-F-F, and they'll be doing a meditation pilgrimage to the Himalayas. I highly recommend it. It's a pretty powerful energy vortex. Surya. Today we have a very powerful episode with a very powerful man, a young man, Matt Maruka. He is the one who founded Raw Optics to make the world's finest blue light blocking glasses and created the Light Diet, a diet that directly addresses the root of modern chronic disease epidemics and mitochondrial dysfunction. He did this after suffering from poor health and chronic disease at a young age due to technology overuse and an indoor lifestyle. He's now only 20 years old and travels the world studying and teaching about the relevance of light in human health. I found out about Matt through a podcast that he did, and you know, he's done so much at such a young age, and he's in high demand for in the health podcast world, because he just has so much knowledge and research, and the way he portrays it is very amazing and easy and digestible, as you know, people kind of get him to explain what his teacher, Dr. Jack Cruz, the wonderful neurosurgeon, you know, he's an amazing guy. Let's do Dr. Jack Cruz. He's an expert in light and magnetism and water. And if you don't know Dr. Jack Cruz, definitely check out some of the podcasts that he's been interviewed. Amazing person to listen to and amusing as well, and absolutely will change your life. And Matt kind of is just making it easy to digest, and Matt's like the protege of Dr. Jack Cruz, so that's definitely worth something that is in his bio, although he hasn't put it in himself because of his humbleness. Anyway, if you already do not use blue light blocking glasses, you really should be. After sunset, you know, the brain is not used to having such high light temperatures in our face with the artificial blue light and everything that's around us. So the blue light blocking glasses shields from that and reduces the light temperature. So our brain, our hormones don't think it's midday, and then all the hormones become disrupted. And also it protects the eyes. There's many, many benefits. Really, you need to start using them after sunset if you're awake after sunset and in artificial light. So you can go to Raw Optics, that's raoptics.com, and get some of the best blue light blocking glasses, some of the most stylish, and use the code VITALVEDA, one word, and you'll get 10% off. Another way you should be shielding from artificial light, especially, is on your computer screen. So for that, you can download a fantastic program called Iris, which we talk about in the show. And if you go to About, on the Vital Veda website, go to About, Friends of Vital Veda, and then I've got the essentials, things that I've recommended, things that I've researched extensively, and the top quality of the essentials in life. One of them is blue light blocking glasses from Raw Optics. And another one is Iris, this program, and it's absolutely fantastic. It beats the other programs for the computer programs that are reducing the light temperature, because it reduces the flicker rate, which we talk about, and you can manually adjust the light temperature to what you have. So for example, the light temperature of a midday sun is 6500 Kelvin, approximately. If you, after sunset, you're watching your computer screen, which is the same, 6500 Kelvin, your brain thinks it's midday. There we go. Hormones get disrupted. Melatonin doesn't come at night, the very important essential antioxidant hormone, and so many other benefits of melatonin is essential. So these hormones get disrupted. So that's why we want to reduce the light temperature, especially on your computer screen. You don't want it at 6500 Kelvin. You want it lower, perhaps towards a candle at like 1900 Kelvin. Anyway, these programs like Iris do that for you, and also the blue light blocking glasses will reduce that. So this is really essential if you care about your hormones, if you care about your eye health. You want to maintain optimal eye health, as you should. You should age, and your eye health should be the same as you were as a young boy or girl. So go to About, Friends of Vital Veda, and I've got a unique link for Iris, which will give you a discount. It's cheap anyway, and it's well worth it. Right, Matt has so much knowledge, and we couldn't do it all. You know, he's done 3 hour podcasts and it's still not enough. So, you know, we could be doing more. So I highly recommend you check out other podcasts with Matt, other podcast episodes that have interviewed Matt, as well as Dr. Jack Cruz. They're similar things, as well as go back to the Vital Veda podcast, episode number 10, The Sun as a Divine Healer for Optimal Health, with myself and Laura Poole. And we talk about the similar things which we talk about with Matt, but we also talk about more about the sun as a sentient being and the divinity and connecting with the sun and the relationship on the more subtle levels and then enhancing your life, and as well as the more science we definitely talk about. So just more information. There's so much more you have to learn about the light crisis we are living in and how to use light as medicine and mitigate the negative effects of lethal light.
Surya.
All right, stick around to the end because I'm going to expand on things that we touched on. As I said, Matt has so much information to tell, and he only touched on things in there. I'm just going to talk, elaborate a bit about it, as well as I'm going to share with you a recording of Matt setting up. Something very cool happened while he was setting up for this podcast. I had the record button on, so I kind of cut it and saved it at the end. It's pretty good, and you'll learn something from it. And remember, you can support the show if you enjoy this podcast. Support it, share it with others. It's a lot of work, this podcast. So share it, send it to a friend, post it on Instagram stories, whatever you want to do. You can donate if you want to. People love to donate as well. That helps. Some people love it. Dylan@vitalveda.com.au. Just send a PayPal to that as a friend. Appreciate all your donations. And thank you so much. Check out all the other episodes. There's another wealth of knowledge of all different areas related to health, consciousness, and the laws of nature, which we call the Veda. Lastly, before we get into the show, check out the show notes. You know, with all these episodes, I've created notes of everything and links and resources and elaborate more detail on the topics we discuss. So for that, go to vitalveda.com.au, click on learn and click on podcasts and choose the episode and get the show notes. And there's also a bunch of other things you can learn there, articles, posters, blog. All right, the man of the moment, Matt Maruca. You're pumping it at the moment, really, like pumping the podcasts, loving it.
Yeah.
And you're known as, well, you were known as the world's youngest biohacker. Do you reckon that's still true now?
I would say so.
Now you're what, 20?
Yeah, 20.
And started doing it at 17 or so, or really getting into
Yeah,
it?
Yeah. I mean, no, I started trying to improve my health when I was like 14, even younger, but really on my own with my own research and paleo diet and that kind of thing was 14 years old. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. And, you know, when I was 17 and late teenagers, you know, I was not fully into this. I was doing a lot of drugs every day and not such evolutionary and friendly relationships, shall we say. But now that's so beautiful to hear. And yeah, tell us about your story, how such a young fella like you is so into health. And
yeah, I mean, it came from necessity. I would say when I was about 14 years old, I just didn't feel very well on a regular basis. I was having problems with my energy levels, but mostly I was having acne breakouts. And that was an impetus for me to try to change my diet. Essentially, I didn't know where to start, but diet seemed to be the thing I could affect. And when I changed my diet, my allergies, my headaches and gut issues, which I thought were these genetic, let's say, diseases, you know, a lot of people have headaches, a lot of people have allergies, pollen allergies, and a lot of people have, well, I don't know about gut issues. I think that was more unique to me. Maybe a lot of people do anyway. But I basically wrote these things off as can't fix, you know, it's just genetic. And so when I had the diet for that, I was trying to fix my skin, and then these other issues started almost miraculously, you could say, improving, I was pretty sold, like, wow, I can improve this. But it was after still having residual effects or residual issues that I tried to get a little bit more strict, cutting out potentially inflammatory foods. And then I ended up not really having big results. And then I came across Dr. Jack Cruz, this neurosurgeon from the States, who's focused on the effects of light on our body's mitochondria, our cellular engines, which determine how we process our food. So that kicked up my interest because I realized that even though nutrition and food and so on has huge effects on the body, if the engines that are processing the food don't work optimally or are working suboptimally, then the diet, even if it's optimal, isn't going to function optimally. So it's almost like the engine is more foundational. And I was just listening to a podcast right now, actually, with Mark Sisson from the Primal Blueprint and Paul Saladino, who's a big carnivore diet advocate today. And, you know, they're like both saying 100%, no one in this community will disagree that food is the biggest of the levers. They called it like a lever to pull that would affect health. And I'm just thinking, like, it's funny, but, you know, I know better. It's not that food is the biggest lever, because food has to be processed, and our mitochondria, the engines that process our food, basically determine our health more so than the food that's coming in itself. Of course, yes, food provides nutrients and so on and so on, but our engines have to be functioning optimally. And, you know, that's sort of where I'm currently focused on learning more and improving. And I've learned a lot already that can help with this. Going to learn a lot more as it goes. I'm by no means, I haven't solved all my, let's say, all the issues I was having. You know, I bet I could still have more energy, but way better than I was before. So it's like a really, I guess, a fun continuum for me. That's why I keep doing it.
Beautiful. And this is, you know, really coming up rather recently, and all the hype and attention, well-deserved attention towards mitochondrial health, perhaps because, you know, back in the day, our vehicles were good, but, you know, we didn't have the modern industrial influences we have today. So I think, you know, we really have to attend to our engines and to the vehicles.
Definitely.
It's just such a radical change today we are living in right now, with the electromagnetic spectrum and power density and the light crisis we're in, which we'll go into. And it's a huge change. So we right now have to tap into things which we didn't consider back in the past.
Totally.
What's the primal, you know, the essential way of healing, and what you've generated is the light diet. Give us a rundown of.
Yeah, absolutely. So based on my current understanding and my research, it's that more than anything, the sun is really good for our health. So there was lots of knowledge way back in the day in ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Egypt, that the sun was very healing and beneficial. You know, they worshiped the sun almost. The sun god was usually the chief deity of all the gods. And for example, there was a battle called the Battle of Pelusium, which was when the Persian Empire conquered the Egyptian Empire. It was, I believe, 1000 BC, somewhere around there, a long, long time ago. And there was a Greek philosopher, I should say Greek historian, named Herodotus, who was evaluating the scene afterwards. And he noticed and noted that the Egyptian skulls were distinguishable from the Persian skulls by the fact that one would easily crack with the hit of a pebble, and the other was rock solid and couldn't be broken. And the Egyptians were these ones. And he posited, rightly so, I believe, that it was because the Egyptians shaved their heads from young ages to allow the light to strike the skull. And so, for example, like, that is such a profound difference. And for example, back then, you know, they were probably both eating grains. This is why it's so interesting compared to the paleo diet. I'm glad I actually happened to just open up that video before, you know, of these two paleo diet or carnivore food focused health people discussing food, because like back then, yeah, the difference between the Persian and the Egyptian diets, I'm not exactly sure how significant it is. Maybe it was the fact that the Egyptians were eating a much healthier diet, but my guess would be that it wasn't a very big difference. They were probably both eating a grain-based diet, which is the complete antithesis of the paleo diet today anyway. And yet there was such a massive distinction in the quality of their bones, and it had virtually nothing to do with their diet, or maybe little to do with their diet. That's a really great analogy for how the sun is so much more foundational in many ways for health than diet, because just that, we, you know, such a huge change in physiology is affected by the light alone, irrespective of the diet.
The diet would definitely be the same. They're both Middle Eastern, and the Persians were wearing hats and turbans. And
exactly. Yes, that's the case. The Persians were covering up with cloths, hats, and everything, and the Egyptians were shaving their heads. So it was just their culture, and they knew about the sun and its benefits. So anyhow, there's lots of historical context for the humans knowing about the benefits of sunlight. Even further back, there's some pretty strong, well, I should say the fact that humans are a bare animal whose skin is exposed to the light should be something that at least makes people wonder, why did we lose our hair when we were living in the tropics in the, you know, coast of Africa evolving from apes who are still generally covered in hair. And most people don't discuss this. It's not even a question that's considered, but the most compelling theory that I've come across is that the reason we lost our hair was so that our skin could become a solar panel to allow us to assimilate more light. So I believe, and I believe the evidence indicates very clearly, that humans are not supposed to be carnivore per se, or paleo, or this or that. I mean, we by nature will be, by doing the things that I'm prescribing, but much further, we'll be solartarian, pescatarian, and aquatarian, meaning we're living by the sea, by water, spending lots of time in bodies of water, eating seafood, which is the dietary source that allowed humans to evolve from apes. That's another thing the paleo meat animal focused crowds miss. What made the human brain evolve from apes? They think it's organ meats. But the thing is, there's lots of other animals like lions that eat organ meats all the time. You know, when they kill animals, that didn't cause the human brain. You know, lions would have human brains if that were the case. So, I mean, not necessarily, but based on their logic, they would at least have bigger brains and be more intelligent. But the evidence indicates that intelligence increases, usually it coincides with increases in the content of DHA, which is the essential omega-3 fatty acid for the myelin sheathing that allows our nerves to conduct impulses. So the archaeological evidence too, lots of shells have been found at human archaeological sites, ancient human archaeological sites in the East African territory. So it indicates that humans ate a lot of shellfish when we moved to the coast, and that shellfish, which again, for an ape, it's, you don't have to fish. You don't have to have a big brain to make a fishing rod. You literally just pull it out of the water and eat it. And it's fatty and it provides you with nutrients. And it, instead of us breaking down omega-3s to burn them as fat, what we actually do is we keep them, unlike, you know, other fats, we'll break them down and release the energy. We keep omega-3s because they allow us to take more energy from the sun. Because it's a unique type of molecule. When ultraviolet light, strong energy light hits it, it has lots of electrons. So it generates basically an electric current of sorts. And that's why we put more of it than any other place in the body into our eye, so that we can take light in, and that DHA helps in the process of converting that light into basically electrical impulses. And so at least that's what the evidence indicates thus far. So all these factors kind of show, okay, humans are designed to be living as a solar organism more than even other animals. You know, our high level complex function that we evolved derived largely from solar exposure. Again, that doesn't mean that food isn't necessary for an organism. Just to preface, like, as a multicellular complex organism, since a long time ago, organisms started eating, you know, using fuel sources. Even since the beginning of all organisms, they were using fuel sources like hydrogen and carbon, which basically want to react but won't react because they're stable in their present bonds in whatever molecules they're taking a form of at that time. But what life would do, or it was started by basically an energy source in these alkaline hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean that sparked these initial reactions, which we could say was the initial spark of life. It's basically like this energy in these ocean vents sparked a reaction, which is life, which continues on today, but it only started once. And that's why, like, for example, if you die, you can't bring yourself back to life. So essentially, we need to use like fuel source, like carbon and hydrogen or something. And then just I want this to be clear. Let me know if this makes sense. Like, you know, we have two molecules that could bond together, but they're already bound with something else. But so what life does basically is we input a little bit of energy, breaking those bonds that those molecules are already stored into, and then allowing them to react with and create new bonds with molecules that are more satisfiable for these atoms, essentially. So the best analogy I can make is fire. For example, if you have a piece of wood and air next to each other, they don't react, you know, because they're stable, especially the hydrogens in the wood. They're stable in their current wood configuration, right? But if you introduce spark, you can cause those hydrogens with that energy to break free from the wood. I mean, it would have to be like really light and easy for the hydrogens to break apart, essentially, because in wood, they're tightly bound. But something like a leaf, you introduce a spark, it can actually break hydrogens free, and those hydrogens automatically start to react with oxygen in the air. And then when that happens, that they make water, and then it evaporates because it's really hot at that moment. But then that energy that's released by that reaction basically acts as a spark to continue it. And so that's how fire works. So life is literally like, it is literally a controlled fire where we input a spark, a little initial burst of energy, break molecules free, again, hydrogen, just like fire. We eat food, apples, figs, whatever, fruits is one example, fats, you know, you could eat fats and break the hydrogens free. And then they bond with the oxygen that we're breathing all the time. And that's how we generate energy. So sun isn't our key main energy source alone, but it fuels the processes of our metabolism by controlling our hormonal systems, things like the synthesis of vitamin D. You could eat a ton of energy from food, but you're never going to get the, you might make ATP, but you're not getting UVB light, which is what we're designed to use to make vitamin D, for example. So there's a lot to the situation of how light is important for health. Now, to get a little bit more towards your question, how do we actually improve and heal? When we go in, basically we just start going into the sun. It's honestly as simple as that. But there's a whole protocol of how we can slowly build up our sun exposure.
Yeah, beautiful. Before we get into that protocol, I just want to go back to DHA, this essential fatty, is it a fatty acid?
Yeah.
What about, I know it's predominantly in seafood, specifically oysters and things like this. What about for vegetarians? Vegetarians and vegan, two separate things, because definitely a lot of listeners are, and I'm personally a vegetarian. How can we get vitamin, how can we get DHA? Can we get it through certain sources like ghee? I've heard ghee has some. What about, can the sun generate through the benzene effect? This is, and talk about perhaps the Indians have been vegetarian, not vegan, vegetarian, so they still had dairy products for thousands of years and were very healthy.
It's hard for me to say for any, you know, this stuff for sure, because I don't know about the context of the individuals, but I am currently of the belief, or at least I'm led to believe, that when we lived in a world without EMF and without artificial light in a natural circadian rhythm, people could do pretty well being vegetarian, because for example, the key thing with DHA is that we have two ways to replace it in our eye, which is the key place we want to have a lot of DHA. One way is by directly recycling what's in our eye. And if we are living in sunlight and not exposed to a bunch of artificial blue light and EMFs, then we're more prone to just conserve the DHA that we already have. However, if we're exposed to EMF, our artificial high energy blue light from screens or sunlight, but we're wearing sunglasses, we're not, you know, getting the full spectrum, then at least Dr. Cruz's theory is that we're going to need to recycle our DHA a lot more. And so that means then we have to get it through the diet, because we're basically destroying it. So we're oxidizing it constantly. So maybe someone who lived in a really healthy environment, like, and is very tuned in, you could say, vegan, vegetarian, could have just lived off the DHA they got at birth, and then the small amount that they could convert from eating like plant foods, which is very almost irrelevant. It's so small. And for example, there is DHA still in egg yolks and in meat and in dairy, for example. So people could have lived without seafood, but not optimally, I would say. So that, based on my current, again, it's hard for me to say all this stuff with any level of certainty. I will disclose, because I met in the last few months a Ayurvedic doctor who I started to work with on some level for my, like a morning routine and working on, you know, my energy systems and all this stuff. Cause I want to take this stuff to the next level. Right. I admit that, you know, although I think I know a lot of things from a Western perspective, as far as Western science and health goes, I think it's super advanced. I admit that compared to the breadth and depth of knowledge that ancient Chinese and Ayurvedic people have about the body, I know very little, you know? So I really want to learn about that. That's why I'm interested in trying it out. And so he's a raw vegan, this doctor. He's Russian, but he lives in the tropics, usually extremely tan, and the healthiest person I've ever seen and met. Absolutely, undoubtedly. And he's a raw vegan. So it's like, do I, of course, I think we can thrive without seafood, and at least he is able to. It doesn't mean everyone will be able to, but you know, he also has probably the benefit of being born very naturally, probably, I believe, from healthy parents and having done a lot of things right growing up. Maybe not though. You know, I don't know his full context, but anyway, I guess the point that I'm making is, do I think it's possible to be healthy without a dietary source of DHA or very little from like eggs and dairy? Yes. But I think it's probably a lot harder in the modern world. So like if I wanted to be a vegetarian, I would probably be more like inclined to be a pescatarian, which is something I've already leaned towards anyway, because yeah, meat has lots of nutritional value in some ways, at least, you know, carnivore diet and paleo diet proponents espouse such. But I think from my understanding, seafood has all the essential amino acids that we need. And shellfish, if we're eating shellfish, also provides us with a ton of the key nutrients for the body, such that we don't need the organ meats that they claim that we need to function optimally. So I guess the best answer I can give you is I don't think, I wouldn't at this point advocate that someone could be living optimally without some amount of dietary DHA. And there's another issue too, is that like a lot of people want to take algae DHA, because there is algae do make DHA before seafood, before fish and so on consume it. The issue with that is that, how can I say, the algae don't change the position of the DHA molecule on its, like the lipid raft that holds it, I guess is the proper term. So basically, it's not as bioavailable. It's not as equally utilized as, or it's not at all compared to the way it is in seafood. And it makes sense because humans evolving wouldn't have been eating lots of algae. It just, you know, you'd have to sift through the oceans to get this. Presumably it wouldn't have been easy. And it's, yeah, it's seafood is the source that we would have, that the evidence indicates we're getting it from, particularly shellfish. Now, an interesting thing I would challenge the vegetarian yourself or any vegetarian is that like mussels, clams, and oysters, so bivalves, they don't have nervous systems, if I'm not mistaken, based on what I've heard. So although they are in the animal kingdom, they are more, in some way, they're almost more like plants. They don't move. They're stuck in place. I mean, so if I were a vegetarian, I think eating shellfish, the French call it fruit de mer, like the fruit of the sea. I would eat shellfish as a vegetarian. I think it is correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it is not necessarily accurate that a vegetarian can't still be a vegetarian while eating shellfish. Now, shrimp, they move, that's different. I'm not talking shrimp. I'm talking just bivalves, oysters, mussels, and clams. They don't move. They maybe a little bit, but not really, I don't think. They just, yeah, they're in the shells and you just eat scallops also. They just like, yeah. That's anyway, so I would thought. Do that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. To be honest with you, I've been vegetarian for years, and on the first time I've ever considered it is hearing Dr. Jack Roos speak about oysters and the benefits, and I actually thought, maybe I'll try some if I find some wild ones. But yeah. No, it's an interesting thought, and I'd have to like look into that more and I guess connect with those sentient beings, even selfish as a sentient being on a, and you know, feel it. And the thing,
yeah, I mean, that's the thing too, is plants are still sentient beings. So it's like the idea, as yeah, I would figure, you know, that, so that's why I say it here, but like, as people know, it's not black or white, of course, like plants too are sentient to some level. They're conscious at some level. It's just lower, maybe level of consciousness than humans, or maybe not lower, but
lower evolution,
different.
Status and
yeah, and so oysters, mussels, and clams definitely fit that that category pretty well as well. So that's why I talk about it. So yeah, that's the take on DHA.
No, so that's great. Individual approach, see the individual, and then of course depends on your environment and also your digestion. How well can you make your own DHA through your own metabolic activity, through whether it's sunlight or through vegetarian sources.
Yeah, I would say, like, you know, the evidence indicates that we're very, very poor at converting it from flax, the ALA form, and flax seeds into what we really need. So, like, for example, this Ayurvedic doctor who I have discussed with, he says, yeah, eat flax. It's a great source of omega-3. But again, it's not of DHA. It's of ALA. And so we'd have to convert it. And do I think that if someone's in the sun a ton and very tuned in energetically that they might be able to convert it better than your average person? Maybe. I think it's possible, but I wouldn't advocate it as a strategy for health. Yeah, so based on what I know right now, unless I saw it done and did it myself. So anyhow, yeah. And of course, eating DHA, if you're eating higher level seafood that are higher up on the food chain, there's a risk of mercury for people who are listening who aren't vegetarians. And so I actually had made the issue, the mistake of thinking, oh, I have good redox. I'm in the sun a lot, which means, you know, redox is like mitochondrial function. My systems work well. I can detox. So I ate a ton of seafood. And then my mercury level, I did some tests. It's way higher than it's safe. So basically, I learned a good lesson. I have to, first of all, detox all that by spending lots of time in the ocean, you know, in the sun. Maybe there's certain herbs and other protocols I'll use and so on. You know, thankfully, I don't feel bad in a sense from that. So great. If I had symptoms, that would be not good. But the point is that you have to be careful. So if I knew then what I know now, I would have focused on A, being in one place. Like I've been traveling the last 2 years working on my business. So that's, I think, been the biggest circadian disruption, stress. That's been the biggest factor preventing me from being able to detox the way we're designed, because we are able to detox a lot of things, including mercury, naturally. Otherwise, you know, if we couldn't, then everyone would have insanely high levels of all toxins, because we wouldn't be able to get rid of them. So of course we have systems to get rid of pretty much every toxin.
And some people obviously do get heavy metal poisoning, and those are those with impaired detox mechanisms. And
exactly, you know, really exactly. And so my detox systems, of course, have been impaired as well. So I could have done two things. I either could have been A, living in one place, optimizing my health, in which case I probably wouldn't have this issue, even if I was eating the tuna that I had been, occasional farmed salmon, which I know isn't optimal and I don't purport it to be, so on and so on. But I wasn't. I was moving around and doing that. So if I wanted to move around and keep doing that, it'd be much smarter, you know, to keep the mercury down while I'm disrupting my bodily functions and natural detox processes. Would have been better to be eating shellfish, sardines, things that are lower on the food chain that have high levels of DHA, but not the high levels of the toxins that older fish and seafood accumulate. So anyhow, good lesson learned. And, you know, working through that, like I said, I don't espouse to be perfect, but there's the knowledge here about the importance of sunlight. That's really, really critical. So for example, stepping away from DHA and into the solar exposure, the best example that I like to talk about is the heliotherapist named Auguste Rollier, who was a Swiss guy in the early 1900s, who, after all the research had been accumulating that sunlight could actually cure tuberculosis of the skin because UV light kills bacteria. And so by shining UV light onto patients' skin, they were able to actually kill the bacteria that caused this disease and basically eliminate this toxic form of tuberculosis from the skin very successfully. Also, sunlight cured rickets, which was, you know, due to poor absorption of vitamin D in the body. So that's why they started supplementing, like, every whole milk that people drink. It always is fortified with vitamin D3. And that alone has covered, I believe, that alone and a little bit less of a fear of sunlight, although we're still indoors mostly, has mostly lowered the risk of rickets. But like, for example, I remember in elementary school, like, kids would always have broken bones. Like, so although they've put just enough vitamin D3 in milk and so on to reduce, you know, the rickets, which is when the bones actually aren't even straight when the child is growing, it's a really bad bone deformation due to lack of ability to absorb calcium, again, due to lack of vitamin D3. They didn't know that at the time, though. But I think what we've done as a society, instead of saying get more sunlight, because I think there's, you know, ulterior motives at some level of society where someone or group doesn't want the populace to be very enlightened, let's say. So there's just tons, you know, good decent amount of vitamin D3 put into milk, and then I think that has lowered the propensity of people getting rickets, but it's still like our bone function, I think, maybe is 10, 20, 30% of where we optimally could be. And as is, I think, the function of us overall as organisms. And so, yeah, that's my current thought. But anyhow, so this heliotherapist started after the discovery that sunlight could also cure rickets in addition to tuberculosis of the skin. There were heliotherapists like this guy, Auguste Rollier, opening up clinics and exposing people of all ages to sunlight and basically healing them of really severe diseases like rickets, tuberculosis, really severe wounds. People came with depression and all kinds of stuff They just were slowly building up their exposure to sunlight. So the basis of the light diet is basically sleeping. Number one is going to sleep with the sun. So like it gets, let's say it gets dark at 8, 7:30, 6, with going to sleep within an hour or two of that. If it's in the winter, you know, just by nature of society, if it gets dark at 5, like it does in a lot of places in North America, or maybe in the south of Australia in the winter, if it gets dark at 5, you know, you might go to sleep at 8, but not 9, not, or maybe 9 at the latest, but like not 10, you know. But the whole goal is to get to sleep pretty early. And the key is that you're waking up naturally before sunrise. That's pretty much the key. So whenever you go to bed, it must be so that one's waking up naturally, basically when it's still dark out, just before the light comes or shortly after the light's coming up. And then being able to go out and actually, and maybe even meditate. Like I like to be able to meditate for an hour before the sun comes up, and then going out, and or a half hour, you know, whatever I'm feeling, but then getting the sunrise. For me, that's optimal. And that is for the circadian rhythm optimal. But if someone isn't into meditating or whatever, being exposed to the incline in light is absolutely critical. And it's so foreign to our perception, but when do the birds wake up? They all wake up at first light. So it's like, it shouldn't be that foreign to our perception, but it is because of our modern circadian disrupted lifestyle. But once someone gets into this habit, like it's like a lot of old people, elderly people, because their body is at a certain point where they understand how they feel when they do certain things. And in order to feel well, they have to live a certain way. They have no choice to keep destroying their biology. So they always eat their meals early, early, early dinners, because if we eat late, it disrupts our sleep and we don't sleep as well and we have problems. They can acutely feel that, those effects. We're just younger, let's say, or less aged. We don't feel those effects as strongly. So we're more inclined to kind of mess up with our bodies, but eating before 5 p.m. is absolutely critical. Last meal before 5 p.m. every, like always, because any later, even if it's healthy food, to me, there's no such thing as healthy food after 5 p.m. It's an oxymoron. It's impossible.
I just want to, you know, correlate this as well with the ancient Ayurvedic teachings. Like, you know, Ayurveda says your digestion, your digestive fire, which is a, you know, core foundational aspect.
Pitta, yeah.
Yeah, the pitta aspect in our body, the metabolic fire, is regulated by the sun. When the sun's the highest, our digestion's strongest. And nighttime, the sun's down, less digestion. And we're about to go to sleep and we want to perform all the vital repair and rejuvenation mechanisms that occur when we sleep. We don't want to be putting our energy towards digesting food, especially a high protein late at night.
So, yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a no-brainer. Like all these people doing carnivore diets, keto diets, intermittent fasting, they're eating meals at like 7 or 8 p.m. because they're fasting after sleeping. And I think it would be way smarter, of course, to eat a breakfast and then a lunch and then fast across dinner, because then the body's fully fasted going into sleep. And it's, for me, it's a much better way to go.
For some people, it's hard because of the family life. And, you know, I understand it's easier for people to, when they're transitioning to intermittent fasting, to miss the breakfast because they don't crave it as much. But if you are going to, it is optimal to have breakfast and lunch. But if you are going to have lunch and dinner, make sure the dinner is light.
Light or early, especially. So yeah, for me, that's the key. So doing that and then going to sleep such that one's going to get their 8 hours before the light comes up. And again, in the winter, it's much easier. In the summer, it's a lot harder for people. You do want to, you know, you'll have to go to sleep earlier in the summer and some compared to when the light is going down, because the days are longer. If one's healthy with more sunlight, also, I think one needs to sleep less, like because there's more melatonin generation being had and so on. So, you know, these are certain considerations, but so getting up, going to sleep with the sun is key. And then waking up early, waking up with the sun and bathing in morning sunlight. That's another thing that, let's say elderly people might not be inclined to take their shirts off and bathe in the light, but they are waking up really early naturally because they're going to sleep early. And this is critical for the circadian rhythm, for health and everything. So that sets the circadian rhythm, sets the body's time cycles and everything. And we want to be, in particular, getting the light of the sun on our eye in the morning to wake us up. That's really, really key. And so I recommend people do this. And then in particular, the most important healing part of the light diet is just bathing in morning light. The heliotherapists, they found that the most effective time of day was morning sun exposure, you know, between sunrise and then when the sun's getting stronger, maybe 9, 10 a.m., depending on, again, if you're in the winter, 9 or 10 a.m. sunlight won't be strong at all. In the summer, it could be very strong. So yeah, so this is really key. And, you know, people can build up their exposure just 5-10 minutes per day, starting with 5 or 10 minutes and then building up each day if you're really pale. And then eating more DHA, more seafood, I have found helped me to obtain really nice color and ability to tan. Also drinking good quality water free of fluoride, chloride, and these toxins, because that allows our cells, better water allows our cells to hold light better also. So these are certain considerations that are part of basically the light diet. Going to sleep with the sun, waking up with the sun, bathing in the morning light, living outside during the day so that we're getting, you know, as much as possible, keeping the windows open. The only reason I don't have this window open now is because of the sound from the cars. I don't want it to interrupt, but I'll be outside all day after this, you know, walking around, working at a cafe or something. And so, yeah, this is like really, to me, really important that this message is understood for people to have optimal health. Of course, you mentioned that you know, with an Australian audience, people have been led to believe that the sun causes skin cancer. Now, there was a study done that with a British university and the university that studied, it was University of Sydney or something. I can't put my name on the exact department, but they were studying skin cancer, and they actually found that people who worked outdoor jobs had lower rates of skin cancer than people who worked indoor jobs. So people need to consider that for a moment. It's basically a great way to simplify and explain it is that, first of all, also people with dark skin, they don't get nearly as much skin cancer. And again, so that does imply that sun is involved, of course, because they are able to block the sun better, the UV light. But the thing is that the fact that people work outdoors should lead us to question, is it the sun or is it the fact that we're living inside, never building up a natural defense system for the sun and then going out into irregular bouts of burning and exposure? Even if you're not burning, still exposure where you haven't built up your solar callus from the early spring into the summer, it's a mess. That's how we create skin cancer, plus a toxic diet, skin that doesn't function well to assimilate light. This is a great way to create skin cancer.
I mean, that's a key it's one. Not about skin cancer. Yeah. It's skin that doesn't function well to assimilate light, impaired skin physiology. Mm. And people are even not only impaired skin physiology, so that they're getting, you know, undesirable light, whether it's blocking certain rays with creams or sunscreen or windows and glasses, but then they're not also not optimally absorbing the vitamin D and the other beneficial spectrum.
No way. Yeah, exactly. There's impossible. And the same thing in the same study, they showed that people who work under fluorescent lighting all day had higher rates of cancers. So these lights, you compare the sun, which is the light that our physiology is based on. We need it to perform key functions. And everyone knows that it makes you feel good anyway. But fluorescent lights, they're stressful. They have a flicker effect because of the power grid. They have a totally unbalanced emission spectrum that's high in blue light, which disrupts our circadian rhythm and our sleep and a lot of other hormonal processes and creates more stress in our body. That's much more likely, just intuitively in my mind, to cause cancer. So it's really just a big lie. And the cool thing is that, you know, I'm just one dude who has a company that sells blue light blocking glasses. It's another step of the light diet to avoid artificial light at night, to block, like the ones you're wearing now, you know, to block blue light, to improve our circadian rhythm naturally and so on. So I, for example, am not like a researcher doing the studies, but there's loads of researchers and studies showing the importance of sunlight even today, like a guy in Germany named Alexander Wunsch, this mentor of mine, Dr. Kruse, who's a neurosurgeon. He's had the most amazing results with his patients by applying these protocols and everything. So yeah, this is sort of the gist of the light diet and why I think it's really relevant for people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people know from experience, you get up earlier with the sunrise, you feel great energy that day. The more you sleep in the bed, although you're in the bed, you feel more tired. And this is related with the elements dominant in the day. And it's a beautiful time in the morning. And in the Vedas, we call it the Brahmin Muhurta, means the time of totality. Anything at that time is closer towards transcendence. Anything you do then is more powerful. Creativity and clarity is in the atmosphere due to the air and space elements being dominant, or the Vata time of the day. And you wake up with that, you capture that energy, and that takes you throughout the day. You feel that creativity, that clarity, that good energy But the more you sleep in, even if you're in the bed for longer, the kapha comes in, the earth element, and you just feel more tired because it's compounding that fatigue. And you're missing that energy, that potent divine energy, really.
So is it accurate that we should be waking up, like based on an Ayurvedic perspective, should we be waking up even before the light comes at all?
The Brahman Muhurta is about approximately 3:30 a.m. till 5:30. So what you're doing is ideal. And that's what I love to do, is wake up, do my morning routine of meditation, and then be finished before sunrise. At sunrise, I go out, greet the sun. You know, it's a divine being showing up on our doorstep every day. We have to, you know, be reciprocal in our relationship of it giving to us, and we have to at least acknowledge it and greet it, and then start the day from there. And then it's just so productive. that's great. And yeah, and wow, you mentioned so many things, wonderful things. But just on the, obviously, and I just want to emphasize, you mentioned, you know, ideally we go to bed not long after the sun sets, but obviously people aren't. But can you talk about what they can do in their environment to reduce the damaging effects of artificial light?
Yeah, of course. So for computers, yeah, absolutely. So for computer screens, like screens are the worst because we look directly into the light source, which means the light's going directly onto the receptors that control our circadian rhythm, which are not, they're not visual receptors. So they're concentrated in the inner retina, whereas a lot of the outer retina, like vision, is a lot of receptors in the outer retina as well. But so it's like the window for our vision might be everything we see now. The window for the light that's affecting our circadian rhythm isn't necessarily as wide. That's one of the reasons why with blue blocking glasses, we don't necessarily need to have wraparound glasses, because it isn't all the light that hits our vision that affects the rhythm. So, but again, it's hard to tell exactly where they are. So it is often just safer just to have all the light coming into the eye blocked. But so anyway, blue light blocking glasses are the best because they block everything directly at the surface. But then for screens, for computers, you can download something like Iris, which is a software for, you know, reducing blue light in screens. You can download Flux, for example, which is another software, but I think Iris is better from my experience. It allows you to alter the brightness without changing the flicker rate of the screen. You can go on YouTube and look up how to make your iPhone screen red. I have a video about this, and there's other people with videos too. That's a great hack for the iPhone. Yeah, you can also do like on Android phones, there's an app called Twilight or Iris Mini, I believe it's called, or Iris Pro, something like this. And then also just changing the lights in the house to Edison incandescent bulbs. So they're warmer lights, it's a higher color temperature. No. Lower color temperature means it's warmer light. So it's like orange, reddish, yellowish color. Red or yellow bulbs or orange bulbs, also they don't have blue light. These can be purchased on Amazon. Replacing the bulbs in the house with these is a great hack for reducing blue light exposure at night. But again, the best is just minimal. I buy a headlamp that hikers use that they strap on their head, and I just use the red light function. You can get these on Amazon, red headlight or whatever. And then I just wear this at night in the dark room just to see what I need to see, turn it off. When I'm reading, I'll use it. If I'm on my computer, I'll use it to see the keys, instead of having a little LED lighting on the keys. So yeah, those are the key hacks of the light diet. For after the sun goes down,
implementing lamps and more warmer colors and definitely,
and candles are great too. Yeah.
Yeah. And beautiful as well. And just definitely not getting those bright white LED lights, you know, even if it's going to save energy, it's not worth your health because you're going to be spending a lot more energy and money when she hits the fan. And can you talk about the screen jitter? What happens? I know that Iris blocks that. I'm not sure exactly, because that can be quite
flicker.
Yeah.
Yeah, so anytime you change the brightness on like a light bulb in the house or on a screen, often for whatever reason, oftentimes there's more flicker. In the house, it's because of lights, you know, everything's an alternating current. So everything, all bulbs flicker to some level in general. But when we turn the dimmer down, it like somehow splices the current, and it creates a big electric and magnetic field where the dimmer switch is, because it's like lowering the current. But it's also creating more flicker. And I don't fully understand the physics, but I measure it with the device. And that basically just stresses out the brain, because it's just basically saying like flicker, 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 bright, bright, bright. And we can't consciously visually see it, but the brains, the systems, these systems perceive it.
Yeah, interesting.
Because they're very sensitive.
Yeah. And can you talk about, I mean, it's a very common thing for people to wear sunglasses in Australia and just glasses and contact lenses, give the whole spiel and that. And then also I want to, you know, great people question. Will argue in Australia, oh, we live in, we got the ozone layer, you know, we got the hole in the ozone layer. So it's,
yeah, there's research that was done in Norway that showed, and again, it's just one study, but it was statistically significant, that showed that even though, so basically skin cancer rates were growing in Norway in the last decades. This was in the 60s also. So I'm not sure how great their controls were, but basically the study showed statistically significantly that skin cancer rates were increasing, but the ozone hole didn't change at all. So there's something that's related to the increase in skin cancer rates that isn't the ozone hole. So that study more implies that when people generally say, oh, skin cancer rates are higher because of the ozone hole, that's not true. Now, in Australia, basically, I would say it's kind of like saying, the best analogy I can give is, it'd be like someone saying, I shouldn't breathe oxygen because there's more pollution in the air. I should stop breathing. So, I mean, anyone who goes in the sun and feels the benefits from my perspective and experience will understand why it's so important, because you become a higher functioning being. And so it's literally like a big deception in my mind, and just total misinformation that's really bringing people down by us not going in the sun at all. And yeah, I think it's a big shame. So if someone's convinced by that idea, then I won't be able to probably change their mind. But when one can, you know, do even further research on the health effects of sunlight, including that it's critical for the synthesis of vitamin D, of course, which controls our immune system, the light coming in through the eye that controls the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus controls the function of our endocrine system, which includes, you know, of course, our thyroid, but it also controls hormone secretions from our pituitary gland, which control a ton of our organs and everything. So it's really like really critical. So to avoid it because of the theory about the ozone hole, that, I mean, there is evidence of the hole, of course, but there's not a significant change in the light that's coming through the earth. I haven't seen any reports of them measuring any unhealthy, unsafe amounts of UVC radiation, which would be toxic if we had lots of it. But yeah, you know, it's still UVA and UVB light. And especially as long as you're not out necessarily in the middle of the day, unless you have darker skin and you can tolerate it and you maybe even need it, then it's not as big of a deal. And again, even if it were, I would still go in the sun so that I can function normally.
Yeah. And I just want to again emphasize, like, we've moved from being 75% outdoor workers to 75% indoor workers. And, you know, we're bearing the sun from our lives more and more, and we're covering up with sunscreen and shading ourselves more. But simultaneously, the skin cancer rates are increasing, and dermatologists can't even put a finger on what's causing
this. That's the key statistic. I often just overlook it. What, if the sun causes skin cancer, why are skin cancer rates skyrocketing since we moved to an indoor lifestyle?
It's simple.
Like, simple enough. So yeah, I appreciate you bringing that one up, because it's so obvious to me. It's like, whoop, it's implied.
Whenever I see patients, I always ask about their history and their family history, and they always mention melanomas. And I said, so your father or your auntie or your grandfather who got skin cancer, did he spend a lot of time in the sun? Usually it's a no. And usually those skin cancers develop where their sun is not hitting. It's in there.
Where the sun's not hitting. And it's like, oh, they spent a lot of time in the sun when they were a kid and they got skin cancer. I'm like, when did they get the skin cancer? They're like, oh, when they were 50. I was like, so how much time were they spending in the sun between their 30s and their 50s? I'm like, oh, they worked in an office building. And I'm like, oh. And so the sun caused the skin cancer from 30 years ago. The sun, the mutations magically started to cause the skin cancer. It didn't have to do with the toxic indoor circadian disrupted lifestyle for 20 years that triggered the whatever. But even if there was something created by the sun, which I don't believe there is based on the research, some issues, some genetic mutations of sorts, that is, the evidence on that is very weak. It's not very strong. I mean, sure, if you're getting fried, sure, you can mutate your genes, but we get gene mutations lots from different things. The body has systems to clean out bad cells. It's when we destroy those systems of, again, like we started the conversation with DHA, when we destroy those systems of selecting out the bad cells, the bad mitochondria. And the way we destroy that is by a toxic, sleep-deprived, artificial light-based, sunlight-deficient lifestyle.
Yeah.
That's the deal.
And a lot of these studies that are showing, that say that sun causes skin cancer, are done on rats who are nocturnal and who, and it's done on the blue light. That's another thing.
Like, yeah, it's done. Yeah, they live primarily under artificial light, and it's done with artificial UV lamps on animals that are nocturnal that aren't really necessarily designed to be exposed to lots of UV light in general. Yeah. So
saying that artificial light causes skin cancer. It's not
fitting. And the first studies that were done were actually done. They were done on albino mice to make matters more worse. They had no natural pigment to defend themselves from the UV light. So it's just a whole mess. So. Yeah.
It takes you to really open your mind and your hearts for you listening to break the social conditioning, especially that's so strong in Australia. You know, people just, you know, go experience it for yourself. This is also knowledge that you have to experience and do the research yourself on an experiential level rather than, you know, being confined to the status quo. And you just feel the benefits. Don't think of the statistics and think, oh, I'm going to get cancer. Feel the benefits of optimized energy. And I just want you to talk about this role of light as, you know, as one of the key prescriptions of your light diet on mental health. And I just like to start off with the Ayurvedic perspective, and then you can put, you know, the modern science.
Absolutely.
The Ayurvedic perspective is, you know, light and sunlight is what we call sattvic, or a pure act. So it increases purity, you know, rather than the other two kind of, we can call them mental qualities or mental body types. Is what the second one is rajas, which is like stimulation, overstimulation, and can create, you know, excess zealousy and anger and irritability, and that can be caused by things that stimulate you, like stimulants like coffee and alcohol and drugs and you know, porn or whatever, stimulating movies and violent movies. And then there's the third state, which is a tamasic state, which means a state of inertia, okay, a state of darkness, depression, and literally what we'll call that is darkness and not acting in life and lack of sunlight and also really poor quality foods that are low in life force, low in prana, like dead foods, and then you're feeling low and dead. So, you know, in the Ayurveda says, you know, being in the nature and being in sunlight will increase the purity and your purity of being and your purity of mind. So can you talk about the modern science take on sunlight's effect on mental health?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward. UV light from the sun, based on the research, shows that when light comes through our eye, we're able to synthesize it, just like we synthesize vitamin D when light's hitting our skin. Light coming through the eye and its effect on our brain pathways and so on basically helps us to synthesize serotonin, which is converted into melatonin, which both affect our mood and our sleep tremendously. Well, melatonin more on sleep, serotonin more on mood, but melatonin also has huge effects on our body's systems overall. And these are hormones that are almost, I like to think of them like sunlight's messengers throughout the body. So yes, they function independently of sunlight in some way, but really their function is driven by the light of the sun. So this is one thing to consider that's very important. Likewise, for example, dopamine comes from an amino acid called tryptophan, which tryptophan, like a lot of other amino acids, like the one that I should say dopamine comes from tyrosine, not tryptophan. Serotonin and melatonin come from tryptophan. But these molecules, tryptophan, tyrosine, these amino acids have something in common, which is that they have a molecular ring in their structure that absorbs ultraviolet light very efficiently. And so it implies that the process of creation of these hormones is intricately or intimately related to ultraviolet light exposure. It makes sense. There's studies that show that people who ate a breakfast high in tryptophan had, and then went in the sun, had higher levels of serotonin and melatonin, basically created throughout the day.
And melatonin obviously is very important, perhaps the most important antioxidant in the body, and is a complete antagonist to cortisol and stress hormones, and also related with insulin. When you have low melatonin, you've got high insulin, and you know, obviously you've done the science and the research on your body about the effects of light on you. What about your relationship, perhaps deeper? Do you have a deeper spiritual relationship with the sun?
I don't know about with the sun. maybe with the universe, I'm sort of working on it. Like, for example, when I learned about, when I started my journey, one of the books I read that fascinated me, someone had sent to me, and I didn't look at it for a year, but then I came to a point where it was calling my name, and I was looking for it for a long time, trying to figure it out, figuring out what the name was. And it was this book, Be Here Now by Ram Dass. Are you familiar with it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I finally found it that someone had over a year ago sent to me. And then I read it and I was like, oh my gosh, like my life doesn't have to be miserable. I can get connected to this greater divine being and be fulfilled. You know, I don't have to just struggle my whole life away. And that was just so amazing. I was like, wow, this is great. And that pretty much kind of launched me into being interested in spirituality. And it was convenient that the books I was reading subsequently from Dr. Cruz's work that he suggested I should, you know, study essentially from these researchers who he was sort of synthesizing together were focused on. It's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because most podcasters don't touch on this kind of thing. But basically synthesizing the work in bioelectricity and bioelectromagnetism and biophotons, meaning like basically light and electromagnetism that's in our biology. And in summary, the standard medical paradigm discounts the relevance of light in biology, electricity, you know, the whole idea of biology is that we're mostly chemical beings based on chemicals and biochemistry, but they're missing. And the reason their understanding of diseases is so lacking is because they're missing the thing that drives the biochemistry, that drives the reactions, that controls the whole thing. One of the key things that fascinated me was why, like one of the researchers brought this up, I never considered it. The eyes, the retina cells, the cornea cells, the nose, the lips, the tongue, the mouth, the teeth, the heart, the liver, the bone cells, all of them have every single cell in the human body has the exact same set of DNA. Exactly the same. So why do they show such massive changes in what the cells turn into? This is the greatest question I think that's ever been asked in biologic science. Why do some cells become one thing and other cells become another thing? What governs that process? Standard biochemistry and also related to that Western medicine has zero answer for that question. This is the greatest question ever asked again in Western biology. And by these researchers, particularly Dr. Robert O. Becker, who wrote the book, The Body Electric, which is often actually advocated via much energy medicine type of people, but they don't have the full context, which Dr. Cruz has been putting together. But the same researchers, Dr. Becker gets the most credit, but also researchers studying biophotons. So he was studying bioelectricity. These other researchers have studied biophotons, but they're all very similar. It's all tied into the chi energetic system of the body, the prana, the chi, you know, and none of them were able to quite figure out how. And I would love to be able to work with researchers one day to get closer to that. But essentially, the point was that when I was reading these books that were asking these great questions, by the way, the answer of what drives this, at least from what the research showed, was electric fields, electric impulses, electromagnetic systems, light and electricity-based systems that signaled basically. He was able even to take cells that had differentiated. Say you say of a blastocyst or a stem cell it's not differentiated. Once it turns into a nerve cell, it has differentiated. He was able to use electric currents to cause cells to de-differentiate and to go back to sort of that primitive stem cell state. His book, The Body Electric, is magnificent. But again, because of certain controversies, public controversies with his work and his protege, who was challenging the safety of high voltage power lines and that stuff, his lab was closed, defunded or cut by the Veterans Administration, which is controlled by the military, of course, or in the government. So anyhow, though, when I was reading these books talking about this coherent electromagnetic field that makes up the body and all this stuff, I was like, wow, this is epic. He even proposed once that it wouldn't be crazy based on what he researched that things like telekinesis too, like moving objects with your mind potentially, but that's much probably harder, but telepathy, you know, people communicating wirelessly. This was implied that this could totally be possible based on the fact that the body doesn't stop at the skin, the field, soul goes further. So when I was reading these things, it sort of implied to me like, okay, although I would consider myself an atheist all the time growing up until reading Be Here Now, I basically started thinking, wow, maybe there is something, because I'm always now open-minded, like maybe there is something to Christianity. Maybe there is something to, you know, these religions. And then I started thinking, well, maybe my ancestors' faith, Christianity, maybe, you know, of course, a lot of it's just stories and tales that aren't necessarily real and true, but they have a deeper meaning that is actually real and true, that even though people today have a much different, we think we're so much more advanced, we don't realize that the problems that we have as individuals and fulfillment in our purpose in life are often probably identical to those of our ancient ancestors, just trying to understand their place in the universe. And so Christianity, all the stories that were synthesized to become what is the Bible today, were sort of the way, the answers that people found on how to live a fulfilling life from way, 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 way back when, from thousands of years ago. So, and several separate continents, these stories that came together to make what's now the Bible. So I started becoming more open to that and just realizing that to me, what I thought about more and more is I consider God, I think I had my best almost definition on the tip of my tongue, but to me, God is the forces. If you want to come from a physical perspective, God to me is the forces that govern the universe. So like, in other words, humans came up with God as a way to barter with the universe, not to barter, but to interact with the forces that govern the universe. So for example, like literally that to me would be the best definition I've got at this point. God is the forces that govern the universe, the force or the forces, depending on how someone wants to put it, or the laws of physics from a physical perspective, same thing, you know, the forces that govern the universe. But literally like, and the reason, the way I thought about this, for example, I'm in Paris right now and I love food. So I love to eat, you know, pastries, eclairs, croissants, even though it's super not healthy. It's refined flour. You know, it's not as, I mean, it's not very nutritional food, let's say. Maybe as a occasional dessert, great. But to eat a lot of, not good. But anyway, and I'm also, my body's also sensitive to gluten, much less so to European gluten and wheat than to American wheat, because I should say American wheat has more levels of gluten, more genetic modification. But still, if I eat too much of the stuff here, which in Paris I'm inclined to, you know, quiche and croissant, whatever. So I was thinking like, How do I reconcile, you know, my tremendous desire for these things, even though after eating them, maybe in the evening I'm laying down, I'm bloated, I'm having trouble falling asleep. I know that one side of me begs desperately not to consume these foods, and another side of me begs desperately to consume them because of the tremendous joy. It's like, it isn't even so much the gustatory pleasure, it's the experience. I feel like I'm in Paris, I'm eating a croissant on a little alleyway at a cafe. It's just such a beautiful idea that I want to engage in, and I probably will. However, I started thinking, okay, I've been asking the same question. Why don't I try different? Let me talk with God. It just came to my head. I was like, why don't I just, let's say, ask God? And then in that moment, I started thinking about it. So if I were like an individual in a previous time speaking, asking God for his advice, for example, you could say, from the way that it would be spoken by one who is faithful and religious or spiritual, I would say basically, God, what is the way, or you know, a better way of thinking about it was the way I thought about it in that moment yesterday when I was thinking about this was, God knows the answer. In other words, if I eat a bunch of a couple pastries or something from a boulangerie or something, then God knows what the result of that's going to be. In other words, the result of that, me doing that based on my current context is fixed, and God knows what that is. And again, for people who are skeptical, I'm just making an example. I'll tie it all together. But God knows what the result of me eating those things is going to be. Again, I might one day, for example, go to Mexico or Costa Rica and not travel a lot and heal my body so that in a different context, I would be able to eat those things and my immune system won't even go crazy. It won't even react like crazy, and it wouldn't be as much of a question. It's not optimal, but it wouldn't be as big of a question of whether I could tolerate it or not. But the thing is, given the current circumstances, my current immune system function, basically the current physics of the situation, if you want to speak from a scientific term, God knows what's going to happen from one course of my decisions. And then the other course of my decision, say I refuse to indulge in anything that is potentially even going to be harming my body because I want to prioritize my brain function, my health, my energy for the rest of the day so that food is my fuel rather than my reason for living. the thing that I came to when I was thinking about that was I realized, like, when I say I'm going to act in line with God, it's almost like saying I'm going to act in line with what, as far as my current understanding is, or what God, you know, tells me. It's almost like my highest self. I'm asking, based on all my experiences, I know that if I'm going to eat the glutinous pastry foods, I'm going to regret it later in the day, even though I might thoroughly enjoy it in that moment. So basically, it's like working with God, it's like deferred pleasure. It's like, you know what's going to be better in the long run. So God, this is tying it all together. God is the analogy or the metaphor or the thing that humans have created, not created, but we gave the name to something that already exists, God, to explain the way that things work independently of our wants and desires. And so it's like, although I would love if I could just eat all this food and just go on with my day, no problem, and feel great, like a lot of other people seem to be able to, well, maybe not because they have some other disease that I can't see or some sickness, you know, like, I don't know what other people's lives are like, but I know that I can forfeit that pleasure presently for a longer term benefit. And to me, that it became clear in that moment, that's what God is. God is essentially the forces that govern the universe, or the force that governs the universe. And of course, to a religious person, a Christian, me saying this is like, well, duh, we already knew that. But I'm just coming to it almost from like having gone really deep down the rabbit hole of biology, of biologic science and all this stuff. Even that leads to the understanding that there are certain forces that govern the universe, which we can understand quite a bit, but we don't even fully understand, and we might not ever fully understand them. But we can, as this Ayurvedic doctor told me, he said, the best thing you can do is to improve your relationship with God or with the universe. So if I were really tight with God, what I would probably say, which I'm working on, I would, because I've been putting the present pleasures of the universe, I'd probably say, you know what, God, I know that eating, for example, this is a great example for me because it's a present thing. It's like, I know that eating those pastries is going to make me feel good in that moment, but I'm going to forfeit it. And can you maybe promise me or help me to, you know, achieve something greater as a result of that? And that's like, to me, the best. So it's sort of a long-winded example and me almost synthesizing my thoughts, but I think you can kind of get to understand where I'm coming from. Like I've come to see that prayer, intention setting, and developing that strong relationship with the forces that control everything, whether one wants to call it the universe or God, is 100% the best way to have meaning and fulfillment in life. Because if one doesn't work on becoming more acquainted with the forces that govern the universe so that we can live more in accordance with them to build our best lives, then what's the purpose? I mean, even just by getting the sunrise every day. So in a way, that's me getting closer to God. You know, I've learned, oh, that's good for me. I should go do that. And each day when I do that, I get a little bit more close to a higher functioning version of myself, closer to not needing the low level physical pleasures of the world to be fulfilled. So that's sort of what I'm working on basically. Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Yeah, I'm glad you think so. That's a really great question. If you couldn't tell, you kind of got me like flowing there.
Yeah,
like,
nice.
Really excited. So yeah, that's the first time I've ever because podcasters don't ask that question. I don't know who listens to this, but you know, that's my current perspective on God. But I told this to my best friend one night on a camping trip, laying in the back of a car, and I like assumed a lot of the time that like what's in my head, other people get and know already, but I realized like that's not the case like at all. And so I explained this to him. I was like, dude, like the idea of God in the Bible, like it's not that crazy. Like people knew what to do to achieve like wisdom and knowledge and satisfaction. And sure, you might disagree with the Catholic Church and what they do and all the negative things that have happened with the church and this and that. But Jesus and the Bible, or different traditions, even different religious traditions, spiritual traditions, doesn't have to be the Bible. It's just because it's the one that's most familiar in my culture, I'm more inclined to start by learning about the Bible. It doesn't mean I'm going to stop by learning about the Bible. Mm. You know what I mean? But yeah, so, and my friend was like, damn, that's pretty deep. Like,
yeah, you recognize it's your higher self. And like, you know, rather than going to the fragmented sources of knowledge and even the science, you know, as these researchers you were talking about, are recognize the vibratory fields. Ultimately, when you go to the, universal, as you recognize, really tap into the laws of nature and that govern the laws of nature, that those energies, that's where the power is. I mean, that's where everything manifests from. So going there, you gain a wholeness of knowledge and in an experiential way. And from that, wow, what can occur?
Absolutely.
So much diversity. And yeah.
I'm going to go sit on a, I'm going to go walk somewhere, sit on a bench. And
you're cringing to get out and,
oh no, I'm not even that. I enjoyed this a lot. I'm really, and you asked such a great question. In fact, you've inspired me to go out and go sit on a bench somewhere and watch people pass by and just meditate and connect to God, to the universe, you know, and just feel into myself for a little bit and just feel it. So I'm awesome, super excited to go do that. And I really appreciate you posing the question.
Okay.
This has been a great conversation.
Okay, guys, thanks for listening. I'm just going to elaborate on a few things. One is the question I posed to him, which Matt did not answer because I was just overloaded with questions and I really asked two questions at once because I was getting overexcited. That was about sunglasses and glasses and contact lenses. You know, these are not recommended to reduce as much as possible. Contact lenses in general, really, you should not use because they block oxygen to the cornea and also they block the ultraviolet. So you want to use glasses as much as possible if you need prescription glasses. And, you know, if you really need the contacts for activities, fine, do it. But reduce as much as possible. Get the oxygen to the cornea. At least the glasses give that. In general, sunglasses, glasses, contact lenses, they block certain UV. So your eye is not receiving a holistic, full, natural spectrum of sun. You're getting an altered spectrum of sunlight hitting your eyes, or light. The same with windows and glass, you know, any other glass. When you sit there, you're not getting the full spectrum of light. It's altered because they block the UV. So when that hits your eye or your skin through a window, that creates an unharmonious spectrum of light, and that is what will cause the disease. That will cause the, that leads to the, you know, impaired skin physiology on the skin, potentially leading to skin cancer. Or if it's hitting the eye, then you're getting a hormone disruptor hitting your eye. So, you know, you really want to lose, especially the sunglasses, you want the full natural light, all right? You want full UV stimulation, which just causes the pupil to contract. And, you know, if you put sunglasses on, you're losing the UV stimulation and you're not getting the full spectrum. So especially avoid sunglasses. The only time you want to be wearing something like sunglasses is at nighttime. And instead of sunglasses, wear blue light blocking glasses. Get the sexy little things from Raw Optics and use the Vital Vader code, Vital Vader, one word, and you'll get 10% discount. So I know you guys, it's a big transition, especially for you who like the style of sunglasses, but, you know, lose it. And if you can't adjust to the brightness, unless you're living in a desert or like a very white environment, you need to strengthen your eyes, you know, squint, you know. Don't use that as an excuse. If you're living in places other than a desert or very light white area and you're sensitive to the sun light, then you need to get your eye health better and you need to adapt. You know, you need to slowly adapt and learn to be able to deal and adjust to the bright light.
Surya.
Another beautiful notion that Matt only touched on, which I want to elaborate on, is the photoendocrinology. What a beautiful topic and word, kind of, I guess, emphasized by Alexander Wunsch, who we mentioned, and you can find about him in the resources. But photoendocrinology, the relationship between light, photo, and endocrinology, hormones. And really, we're talking about the light-mediated hormones, and that so many essential hormones are mediated by light. There are three aromatic amino acids which are precursors for essential hormones, and which are the precursor of those amino acids is sunlight. So, for example, Matt mentioned sunlight creates tryptophan, and tryptophan is what creates serotonin, which is obviously an essential neurotransmitter, and it also creates melatonin. Then there's another aromatic amino acid called phenylalanine, and that creates T3, T4, thyroid hormones, and flavonoids, and DOPA, which creates melanin, the skin pigment, which creates dopamine, again, the essential neurotransmitter, as well as adrenaline and non-adrenaline. So these, and the third amino acid is histidine, and this which stabilizes hemoglobin in the blood. So there's so many important precursors to these important hormones, and these, what the precursor of these precursors are sunlight. So sunlight's going to cause the secretion of these aromatic amino acids that are going to create these essential hormones, like, once again, dopamine, serotonin, melatonin, the most important antioxidant in the body, and which reduces inflammation in the brain and regulates sleep and so many things. And there's heaps of other light-mediated molecules and hormones like POMC, and which has 241 amino acids. And all these are in antagonist with blue light. So blue light increases cortisol, which is the antagonist of melatonin. So the stress hormone will increase when the melatonin's low. And there's just so many... it's really essential, the light hormone relationship, and most of that happens through the retina, through the eye. So that is why we need to be careful of our exposure to artificial light at night, and also in the morning. We don't want to wake up and go straight on our phone. And you know, I don't expect you guys to fully ditch it, everything, but definitely reduce as much as you can. And for when you are using it, shield using the raw optics sunglasses, blue light blocking glasses, and the iris is an absolutely amazing program, which every single person who uses a computer should absolutely have. Surya. You made it to the end. Thank you. You are a Vital Veda diehard fan. No, I'm joking. You are just devoted to yourself and your own health and well-being and elevating your state of consciousness. By the way, that little Surya, that Surya is the sound of the sun, the Sanskrit sound of the sun. If the sun had a sound, it would be Surya. That's the sound that nature's intending to make in the form of sun. So just for those who don't know, and as promised, I'm going to leave you with, when Matt was setting up for the podcast, the little biohacker did a little something which you can learn about. Here it is, and until next time.
All right, so I'm sitting right next to the Wi-Fi router, but it will be
not for long.
Be all right. I can handle it this one time.
Yeah.
In fact, you know what? Just for the purpose of discussion, let me think about this for a sec. I can actually turn off the router and plug in with my Ethernet cable. So could I take like about 3 or 4 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
And just do that? Because then I'm hardwired and then I'm not even going to be thinking about it. So
nice.
Let me just...
To be able to plug in, like, not all places...
Oh, every Wi-Fi router has Ethernet. So
oh, you just plug into the Wi-Fi router. Okay.
It's just a matter of, yeah, of utilizing it properly. I turn off the router's Wi-Fi capabilities by going into the settings.